And that was Robert Butler's Pantychrist version of Everybody's Happy Now from Aldous Huxley. And it's time for Gnostic Media's podcast, episode number 213. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode discusses mind control in the UK and discusses overlap between the US and UK mind control research programs and is called MKUltra in the UK. And was recorded on Thursday, September 18, 2014, and is being released on Sunday, September 21, 2014. My guest is Kathy Morgan. Kathy was initially a homemaker, earth mother, ABM voluntary breastfeeding counselor, and carer for her child with cerebral palsy. The UK MKUltra situation is barely being discussed. In this interview, Kathy Morgan shares her research into UK mind control from a personal perspective in an attempt to stimulate research and discussion of the topic of UK mind control. In this episode, we'll find many players who overlap between both the US and UK mind control research programs. And Kathy's website is www.mk.gowebs.co.uk. That's gowebs.co.uk. And donations. This episode is brought to you by Derek, Alan, Tino, Robert, Kathleen, Casey, Bill, Lewis, Megan, Brenda, Zdravko, Nicholas, John, and William. And we didn't have any Bitcoin donations this week, so any of you Bitcoiners out there, of course, we always appreciate all of your support too. And this episode is in both video and audio versions, and the video version actually went out sometime early this morning or late last night. And of course, we do our best to provide just about everything at Gnostic Media for free, so your donations and website purchases are a huge help. And so we ask that you sign up for a membership or make a donation because we can't do it without you. And this week we have brand new Trivium Education bookmarks up on both the Gnostic Media and Trivium Education websites. So check those out. You can also check out the books and archives, t-shirts, DVDs, etc. up there. The views expressed by the authors and guests are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. The website is GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com. Reach me through the contact form or directly at contact@GnosticMedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here's my interview with Kathy Morgan, MKUltra and the UK. Enjoy. Kathy Morgan, how are you doing this morning?
Hi, Jan. I'm good, thanks. Although it's afternoon here.
Yeah, well, I suppose it is the morning here. It's so bright and early. It's the sun's not even up here in Southern California, so I guess it's not sunny Southern California quite yet. So, welcome to the Gnostic Media podcast. Why don't we have you start out by discussing a little bit of your background and education. I think you had you went to school for music, is that correct?
Oh, well, that was my degree later. I did that as an adult, actually. I got a music degree in 2000. That was the bachelor's degree. And after that, I became a college lecturer for
College,
3 years.
right. You have an IT and or a background in IT as well?
Well, it's just something I picked up while I was doing the music, really, and that's where the work was. So I went with that. There were jobs on offer.
So let's see. You want to talk about your background much? You want to go into where you went to school or any of that good sort of stuff?
Sure. Well, I was born in the north of England in a place called Rochdale, which is just north of Manchester. And at the age of 4, my family moved to Bath in Somerset. So, well, just before we were 4, we started school in Bath. And the school we attended was a Catholic school. And the nun that ran it, who was the headmistress, was called Sister Ignatius Loyola, which is quite an unusual name for a nun. You don't come across it very often, at least not when I've tried to research it. And it's the name of the founder of the Jesuits. So I thought that was a kind of interesting point there.
Interesting. You know, I'm just getting up here, but I'm trying to get some bulletproof coffee in me so I can wake up. So you'll have to excuse me if I'm still a little bit groggy here. Let's see. Why don't we get into, well, you know, first off, we had tried to do an interview about a month and a half ago, and at the time your computer was getting old, and we actually did a public, a crowdfunding for you to get yourself a new laptop. So the audience may see on this bright new shiny laptop camera that you have that you got yourself a new laptop. So congratulations.
Well, thanks, Jan. I'd just really like to say thank you so much to everyone who helped me with that because it's made an enormous difference to me and my research. And as you say, I have a nice shiny video now, which we didn't have before. We didn't have a connection, really, did we?
No, we didn't. In fact, it was clipping out every like 20 seconds, I think, when we had tried to record it. I still have it. Maybe I'll clip in a few seconds just so people can see it compared to now. You're a little red. You got a red light bulb going on there.
No, I don't know what it is actually.
That's all right. I wouldn't worry about it. Let's see. Test 1, 2, 3, 4. A little low. Testing, testing. Kathy, you want to give me an audio check?
Okay, how's that? I don't think my mic's very good actually. It's built in the computer.
Well, it'll work as long as you have headphones on. It looks like we've got some delay here. I don't know
Okay.
why. Do you have anything downloading or anything?
I've got, well, I was going to use the brain, but I can't run it. I don't think it would be enough memory. So I shut that down. But, I'm not even, my web pages are all offline. It's an XP computer, so it's a bit bloody slow, actually.
So let's see. What made you then? Well, let's just get into the meat of the material here. We brought you on to discuss essentially mind control in England and your upbringing, and then some overlap I noticed in your recent lecture that you just gave in England while you were there. Presented some new information. You also, I noticed you incorporated some of my work into your new lecture as well. And so, why don't we start off though first by going into how did you first come to think that you were experimented on as a child and teenager?
Well, I began to wonder about that when I actually had an episode of post-traumatic stress disorder because I unfortunately was involved in a relationship that involved domestic abuse. And I was so surprised at my symptoms afterwards. And after researching that, I found out it was post-traumatic stress disorder. And when I read about post-traumatic stress, I re came to understand I'd already had it as a child. I started to then think about my own background and wonder that I was subjected to some sexual abuse as a child, which can cause post-traumatic stress. But when I started to look into other things, because I had never really sat and looked at my life as a whole and thought, oh yeah, this is me, this is my history. So I was a kind of a little bit dissociated, really. And so I looked into where we were, where we moved to, why, what school I went to, and found out that we moved to an area that was 3 miles from a deep underground base, which is called Rudlow Manor in England. That there were three huge military bases in Bath that were secret at the time. This underground base was also a huge military bunker for the elite, really, for the Queen, for royalty, for members of Parliament, if there was a nuclear attack, with sort of 60 miles of underground railway and different levels. And that was only declassified around in early 2000. Maybe 2003. So that made me sort of think, oh, I wonder if something happened to me, because I'd heard of MK Ultra by then. And so I started to interview my parents on video, because I thought this could be evidence. It's no use just talking to them and then saying to people, oh, my parents said this. So that is much more effective if you've actually got them saying things on video. So I videoed it, and a few things came out of that. One being that they explained that we were part of, well, I knew I was part of a National Child Development Survey, and this is where the government decided to take all the children born in a particular week and to follow them through their lives for, and this information that would be gathered would be available to any researcher that applied to access the information. But we were visited around every 3 months by a doctor who came about an 80-mile round trip, really. And when I looked at the documentation of that survey, nobody else was visited. Nobody was even contacted till they were 6 years old. But up until the age of four, when we moved to Bath, we were visited every 3 months. So that was another little indication.
Now, it appears that there is a lot of overlap between the UK and the United States regarding MKUltra experiments. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, the information I could find about MKUltra was mostly from the United States. So I kind of read up on it and realized the significance of the MACE conferences.
Right,
So,
sure. That's a huge one.
yeah. So my sort of next question was, well, who attended the MACE conferences from England? And that one of the people, well, there were several people. I came to this in a roundabout way. If I just sort of mentioned that my parents also said that my grandmother constantly said we were associated with somebody called a Lady Moran. So I looked on the internet to see who Lady Moran was, and she was the wife of Churchill's doctor, Lord Moran. Now, she, her tutor who worked at Portendown, she also worked at Portendown, was also tutor of William Grey Walter, who was a cyberneticist. So then I realized that he attended the MACE conferences. That's how I got to look at the MACE conferences. William Grey Walter and his close associate, Ross Ashby, were both attendees, and they were both doing some interesting work that appears to have been pre-MKUltra, but of the same nature of mind control and the physical aspects of mind control, the measuring the electricity of the brain, and you then using brain frequencies to say, for example, turn on a television set. This was very early research. This was in the sort of just after the war.
Did you ever find any research that proved that you were a victim of MKUltra, or you have a lot of strong evidence and suspicions?
It's
circumstantial.
Yeah. Right.
All right. So let's talk about LSD units and experimentation.
Right. Well, I began to sort of read more widely and found out about LSD experimentation in England, and it was all very much under the NHS, under the umbrella of the NHS. It wasn't secret, although you won't find very much about it if you go and have a look. It's not, you know, there on Google right at the front. But there were many hospitals there were LSD units offering LSD therapy in England, and they include the Potwick Hospital and the Chelsea Hospital. Somebody called Ronald Sanderson was working at Potwick and Chelsea, and also at the Birmingham University Hospital. Now, this is to name a few, because I'm sure there are more. But as I say, it is quite difficult to find out this information. In fact, I got this information initially from a writer called Al Borelli, who wrote a book about MKUltra doctors.
Right, yeah. You know, and the interesting thing is that Al Borelli was a former lawyer for the Carter administration White House when MKUltra went public. And Al Borelli actually took me and my research on a wild goose chase for a while until I caught him and exposed him in 2013. So really interesting character there. You know, a lot of his research, I feel, exposes smaller, older aspects of the MKUltra program, such as regarding the Frank Olson murders, such as regarding Manchurian candidate style experiments, but totally plays up the official version of the story regarding Wasson, regarding the Cultural Revolution, and all of this stuff that, as you know, and you've read one of my newer articles that I haven't released yet, you know, and that goes in and exposes a lot of this other material. Why don't we get into compensation?
Right. Well, people in the UK have received compensation, but it was a bit pathetic, really. They didn't get very much money, and there was no admission of liability from the hospitals. One person they were doing LSD research in Crumpsall in Manchester, because an article about compensation describes how a woman was unable to get compensation because she couldn't afford the legal fees to sue, which is dreadful. And in the end, only 44 patients were compensated, but the amount in total for all of them was £200,000. So it was pretty pathetic by the time it got to court.
So you're talking about like
15 hospitals.
You're talking like £5,000 each for all of those people. That's not even worth the time. You know, the time to sit there and go through the courts and everything, that's wow, that's pretty ridiculous. Okay, so let's talk about some of the projects there in the UK.
I've only heard rumors. I've been trying to find a project that would match my experiences. And I've only heard rumors, really, of a project Oak Tree, which was apparently called Project Anvil in the UK. But I haven't been able to find out anything more. They were supposed to be where hospitals were on the alert for children who were exceptionally bright, who were then pulled out of class and subjected to special lessons and so on. But I haven't really got any more on that. I haven't even got evidence on that. That's just hearsay, really. So
What can you tell the audience about Project Oak Tree? And I've heard a little bit about it here in the U.S. It pops up rarely, but you had an interesting story. Didn't you go into some town where you were somewhere and somebody actually brought to your attention Oak Tree and you were looking into it at the same time?
That's right. Yeah. I was going to do my first presentation in Nottingham, and when I got off the train, I sort of saw a bunch of approachable-looking people outside of hairdressers. So I thought it was a coffee shop, actually, the way that they were sitting around. And so I went and asked them for directions. And excuse me. When I said I was doing a lecture on mind control, the chap I was talking to, who was called Jonathan, said, "Oh, I know about Project Oak Tree." So I was really shocked because I'd been trying to find about Project Oak Tree on the internet. I hadn't really managed to find anything from not from a reliable source. And so I stayed in touch with him, and it turned out that his father was a member of the Special Overseas Services, the Baker Street Boys, that were doing undercover work after the war. They were going in and cleaning up, looking for equipment, looking for resources that could be appropriated by the Allies, by the UK. That was what his dad was doing. He was working for MI6, basically, and he had two identities and two birth certificates. And I have verified that information. Indeed, he was. He's in the records. Now, Jonathan's been interviewed by Miles Johnson here, and the basis, there are some expose-type interviews on these areas, one called the basis.
Who's Miles Johnson?
He's an interviewer and researcher. He basically witnesses approach him, and he puts them in front of the camera to give their testimony. So you can find an interview with Jonathan.
Now, in the lecture that I saw you present, I don't know if it was maybe 6 months or a year ago that you gave, you talked about something that was going on with alien pods. What's the story about alien pods?
Oh, alien pods, right. Well, my grandchildren are aged 4, 6, and 8, I think they were. I went around to visit them. I said, "What did you do at school today?" They said, "Oh, Nana, an alien pod landed in our school." And I said, "Oh," you know, they gave me this whole story. They arrived at the school. There were police cars there. There were men in forensic suits. The teacher had an area roped off, and there was a canvas covering something that was smoking, and a scientist doing readings. And eventually they were told it was safe to walk past. And this crazy story. And so I said, "Well, was it real?" And they said, "Yes, it was real. It was real." And then I looked on the internet to see what the heck was this. And other schools were running the same class. And it was every single one was fooling the children, not telling them that this was fictional.
You think it was a sort of a psyop to test the children on alien pods and bring in the police and everything to make it look official?
Yeah, I think it was a psyop to... my personal opinion is to put into those children's minds that aliens do exist, and the government takes them very seriously. That's my opinion.
Even though they fabricated the whole thing. Interesting. All right, let's cut into Project Bluebeam.
Right. Well, I had already come across a description of a so-called Project Bluebeam, which maintains that in order to roll out a new world order, the governments of the world need something to unify us. And at one point it was discussed that a possible way to do that would be to fool the public into thinking that aliens were attacking us, and therefore a one world government would then have to be implemented.
You know, and I remember going to a lecture in the 90s, this investigative journalist in the United States by the name of Dave Emery discussed, this must have been 92, maybe earlier, discussed the whole idea of the governments using aliens as a cover for this exact sort of thing.
I think they're using the ecological disaster.
Yeah, they found Agenda 21 to be much more useful, you know, and they can get everybody studying their environmental footprints. And meanwhile, it's these corporations and the governments and everything that are tearing everything up, and they blame the average people for causing the damage. And, you know, certainly we have some of our impact, but when you look at these large corporations, when you look at the militaries, when you look at the governments, they create most of the waste and the pollution.
Yes, it's almost like there's very much guilt and fear of very much part of that too, making people feel that every tea bag they throw away and every light bulb they leave on is going to, you know, that they ought to feel bad about it. But as you say, if you just look at down the road at one of those huge factories that are blazing lights all day long, then it sure just shows how ridiculous that is.
Well, you know, and the interesting thing is, there's a lot of evidence and more coming to light all the time that quantum physics is just another one of their big farces. And it's probably something more along the lines of plasma physics. But in either case, there's a lot of evidence out there that shows that the universe is made up of energy, and that the idea that, you know, suddenly we're going to run out of energy in itself is pretty absurd. And meanwhile, they've forced the combustion engine vehicles on us. They've forced these modes on us. And, you know, in the United States, in the early 1900s, they essentially went around and got rid of the electric cars before they even got off the ground. In the United States, electric cars actually had a better start at the early turn of the 19th century than did the motorized cars. And then those were all pushed out and didn't make it back until the last 10 or 12 years or so. But, you know, even the electric cars have their issues because of the big batteries and all of this stuff, you know. And it's like in the United States, they have all of these gasoline hybrid cars. And it turns out that the gasoline hybrids get the exact same mileage as a standard old diesel, you know. And so, like, if you drive a Volkswagen Golf diesel, you know, and the funny thing is European car companies like Peugeot and Seat, et cetera, have diesel hybrids that get 160 to 180 miles a gallon. So, you know, I mean, obviously they're not concerned about the environment. They're more concerned about their profits and making sure that people don't actually get cars that could get, you know, close to 200 miles a gallon.
Oh, it's just dreadful.
You know, if you can imagine a car that got 200 miles a gallon, you know, most people would probably only need to fill it like twice a year, you know. So, go ahead.
I know it's such a scam. The whole thing is such a scam. And when you start to realize these facts, you just see the construct of our society, our culture is just so fake. It's all an illusion.
It really is. It really is. And, you know, the issue is that most people don't want to question. They don't want to ask who, what, where, when, why, and how before they reach conclusions. They take whatever some authority gives them as fact. They don't check it, and then they just kind of go on repeating it. And it's really key to learn how to verify all of the thoughts and ideas in our heads ourselves, and to learn to trust our own five senses to do so. And that's, you know, really part of the century-old quantum physics scam. And I interviewed a couple of years ago this guy, David Harriman, who's done a lot to, and he actually used to be a professor or lecturer at the university at the bottom of the hill here. But he's done a lot to expose it, as have others starting to come to light. And, you know, the whole thing is just, it's so incredible how they'll weave, you know, the whole, when you get quantum physics, and not necessarily quantum mechanics, but quantum physics and especially the Copenhagen interpretation, you realize that the whole idea of this is to get people to not trust their own five senses, that they can't go and look things up, that, oh, there's 11 parallel universes, anything could have happened, right? Well, you know, the onus of proof is on the person making the claim that your car suddenly elevated to another level, that when you go to the grocery store, you shouldn't get the proper change, put in your hand and all of this stuff, you know? So they, you know, it's like always this appeal to emotion. Of course, quantum physics is based on the Jewish Kabbalah. So it's just, you know, more of the same crap repackaged and remarketed.
All right. Well, I don't know much about science or quantum physics, but that's interesting. I will look into that, actually.
Yeah. You know, I after the show, I can send you some stuff to listen to. And David Harriman, he did a 6-hour lecture series called The Philosophic Corruption of Physics that really lays it out. I mean, if you do a couple hours prerequisite study in logic and logical fallacies and things like that, it would tremendously help you, you know, comprehend the topics that he's discussing. But once you have that, it's plain as day how they faked it. So let's get into the joint hearings on MKUltra. What types of control did the hearings reveal?
Well, I won't say I have researched MKUltra in any sort of thorough sense whatsoever, because all my research was trying to find out about what might have affected me. So that was completely my my focus of intentions. I mean, I did read quite widely about MKUltra, the control, the five methods. That the CIA used was substances that promote illogical thinking and impulsiveness to the point they'll be discredited in public. This is from the hearings. Physical methods of producing shock and confusion over extended periods of time, capable of surreptitious use. Materials rendering the induction of hypnosis easier or enhancing it. And substances that alter the personality structure in order to make a person more dependent on other people as well.
Right. Yeah, they're always promoting the socialist ideology. They're really pushing it heavily in the United States lately. Canada's getting hit incredibly hard by this socialist ideology and trying to, you know, they're basically trying to turn the West into Soviet Russia, you know, and then we see the Russians becoming more and more and more free. Always an interesting turn of events, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can see it here in England, too. And the other ways they stopped people from thinking too much was the way they worked on the manual for psychiatric conditions in such a way that they actually say that if you think in a narrative, you vocalize thoughts within your head, you could possibly be schizophrenic because you're hearing voices. I mean, it's just that ridiculous now.
Instead of thinking things through and whatnot, you're hearing voices. Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, so other than that, and let's get back to the CIA, but what are the five methods that you documented that the CIA uses?
The there was the drug program, the MKUltra programs included radiation, electric shock, psychology and psychiatry, sociology, and harassment substances. I'm not quite sure what that means, harassment substances.
Yeah. Hmm. All right. Was the Macy Foundation funding UK experiments as well as here in the US?
Not directly. There was a great article that was published just after the MKUltra hearings in 1979 by a chap called Duncan Campbell of the New Statesman, and he said that it was not done in such an academic way as it was in, I just had that article up too. I might just bring it up because there's one or two points that he made. But he was talking actually about Dr. Eysenck, who was funded, who has been shown to have been funded by the CIA and he was working in Britain at the Maudsley Hospital. Now, the Maudsley Hospital, we're talking about the 30s here, has a lot of the usual suspects that later became involved in the Macy conferences that were working there. So we had Dr. Ross Ashby was working there. He was a Macy attendee. He was working at Maudsley in the 30s. So was Eysenck. So was William Sargent.
And William Sargent, he's one of the another one of the key architects behind a lot of this stuff, and he wrote a book called The Battle for the Mind that covers many of the various pronged approaches that we've been exposing on Gnostic media for the last couple of years. But he was really, probably he may have been like the UK's version of Aldous Huxley, who is from the UK, and as it turns out, I think Gregory Bateson, who was also behind the Macy conferences here, was from the UK. And then, of course, Gregory Bateson was married to the famous, sociopathic anthropologist, Margaret Mead. And, so there's all of the, this nexus. And, the anthropology, psychiatry, psychology, etc., play heavily into all of this. And we've discussed on my show often something called weaponized anthropology, which is something that Gregory Bateson had brought back from him from the Soviet with him from the Soviet Union. And it was initially called native, well, one aspect was this native revivalism, which got morphed into the archaic revival, but essentially the idea was to collide cultures together, and you promote the native ideals, and the idea was to allow these native groups to put on their art shows and displays and things like that to keep them under control, to make them feel appreciated. But in Gregory Bateson's declassified OSS letters published by Professor David A. Price in his work on weaponized anthropology, he shows that all of this stuff is basically flipped and then used on the larger population. So basically what they did was they took everything, they flip it upside down, but we see them using this weaponized anthropology on the public all over the world, the promotion of shamanism, all of this stuff. And I know in your most recent lecture, which I'll put up for this episode for people to watch, you talk about, well, you feel it was a fun time, the Christian groups needed to be broken up, but the idea was to get us caught up and into the fun so that by the time we're in our 40s and realize what was going on, we don't have our lives together like we would have otherwise. I mean, if say you and I had our act together in our 20s, where would we be today as opposed to later on? So, that was actually the intended goal of these programs, and to, promote feminism and the drug use and the partying and all of this stuff as an attack on the extended family and the backbone of society. Because obviously, if you have a strong extended family and the government collapses, you're not really going to care. If you've got a little ranch, you got your cows, your horses, your pigs, your chickens, your sheep, you're not really going to care if the government disappears. So the government really loves to break all of that down. And so if they can get a bunch of women out having free sex and free love and getting pregnant, and then, there's no father figure in the home, then these mothers are reliant upon the state. And then they can perpetuate this socialist program. And of course, single mothers aren't going to retaliate if they're beholden to the state for their income and, for any additional support, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah, the breakdown of support systems and the family. I mean, it's really been accomplished now. The falling birth rate too in Western countries, like in the UK, of course, if you're a feminist and you're making free love and what have you, and there's lots of gay people around, and you're moving away from the normal nuclear family, then the birth rate drops, and it has dropped. It's below maintenance level now. Therefore, this is the excuse given for bringing in lots of people from other countries,
Right.
immigration,
Mm-hmm.
we need to do that. But that again,
multiculturalism. And you know what's interesting is I find these Zionist groups promoting all of this multiculturalism, while when you look at Israel, it's an apartheid state. You know, you couldn't be a larger contradiction. So clearly the multiculturalism is being sold to everyone else as a way to basically try to break, you know, the different societies. And then you have the promotion of low-fat diets, which affects two things primarily. Number one, the brain, and number two, the reproductive system. And, you know, I've interviewed Curtis Duncan before. He might actually be coming on again soon. But he exposes, you know, the chemicals in the water and the food supply and all of this stuff that are actually designed to masculinize females and feminize males. And a lot of his work exposes the additional layer of the, you know, this is essentially creating the homosexual mentality in society on top of the low-fat diets and all of this stuff. And a lot of people think it's genetic, but when you look at how they've played with the food, with the water, with the air, and you know, the low-fat diet and all of this stuff, it paints a different picture. You know, maybe some of it is genetic, but there's a lot of other evidence there that also leads to another direction.
It is. It's so sophisticated because it's an onslaught on so many different fronts. As you say, the people have been sold lie after lie about the additives in the water, the additives in the food. Oh, you don't know. You don't bother cooking. You know, don't bother growing your own vegetables. And constantly,
constantly sold convenience and all this.
Yeah, and I worry that if we don't suss this out, the next generation isn't even going to be capable of.
Well, I think that's the plan, is they're trying to wipe out the next generation, you know. And there are a lot of people waking up and realizing, and we've been promoting the Trivium method for critical thinking, you know, for people to be able to see their way out of it, and how they use logic and fallacies and sophism to trick and manipulate people. And basically you're looking at, you know, what these people are is, you know, psychopaths. You know, Aldous Huxley, who and I'm getting ready to publish a paper exposing him with a lot of documents and things from his own letters and books that show him as one of the key figures behind MKUltra. But aside from maybe Trotsky, Aldous Huxley is probably the worst psychopath that I've ever studied.
Interesting. I can't wait to read that in more detail and study it, because what I love about your work is that, as well as not perpetuating fallacies and so on, you also document everything. So that's
All these people attack me. Your work challenges my beliefs. It's like, well, you know, there's the quote. It's not, you know, I'm just quoting what these people say. There's the primary citation. You can go to your university library and look it up, you know. Let's get into the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yes, because I was going to say there's more evidence of when you asked had Macy funded British scientists and doctors, no, but the Rockefeller Foundation did very much so. I've seen, like, you can go and download the manuals going way back, the documents from the Rockefeller site that tells you what they're funding. And so I know I've seen that document that says they're funding.
They also do a lot of the funding for the Agenda 21 stuff, and you can see them funding a lot of these things back in Gordon Wasson's letters, who, of course, was the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms.
Right, yeah. I noticed that there was somebody associated with similar kinds of promoting the whole kind of mystical side of drug taking, and in England, because I'd actually gone to the organization where he had worked, or the association that he founded, when I was a teenager. And I, at the time, If you didn't have a student card, this shouldn't have done it, but they did provide us with student cards. Then they kind of were forgeries, really. But what amazed me, this is so you could get cheap transport, and what amazed me was the cost that he put on my false student card was that I was studying human ecology. The guy, and of course, the Human Ecological Society was another
The
fund.
human ecology fund and all that, right.
And that was extraordinary. But he's talked with, on the same bill as Terence McKenna about mystical experiences. This
I think I have a note for him. Are you talking about Saunders?
Nicholas
Yeah,
Saunders.
we'll get back to him in a little bit. And it looks like he was going around with Robert Anton Wilson as well. And we know that Wilson was an agent. Wilson even did a lecture series with this other guy that was a gun smuggler and admitted agent as well. So a gun smuggler for the government.
So here you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
The people that were promoting these alternative, and they were very alternative
Well, sure,
things.
but that's the idea. But they want to wrap it all in this mysticism and so-called spirituality to lead people over there. And when you realize, and this took me a long time. It was 3 or 4 years ago. I was on a long drive back from Mammoth Mountain, Mammoth Ski Resort. And on the way back, I was listening to this lecture. And at the very last tape of the lecture, the guy's talking about mysticism is the tool of tyrants. When I first heard it, I thought it was just the most outrageous thing. How could you say, but at this point, I had already began studying the trivium. I had already studied a very long logic series, like, 4 or 5 times over. And things were starting to click in my head. So as I'm on this long drive, I'm thinking, well, instead of attacking this guy for saying mysticism is the tool of tyrants, why don't I find some instances where it isn't that and that where it couldn't be used for that? And so I sat there in the car thinking and driving and thinking and driving, 3 hours, 4 hours later, still thinking, 3, 4 years later, still thinking about it. And I haven't found any that you could prove. That's not to say that spirituality or, something out there doesn't exist. I mean, we pick up a pine cone, we look at things in nature. I mean, just going through the trivium and quadrivium, we discover amazing things, but I don't think that they're in any of the religious texts written by the elites over the last 2,500 years, right? I think it's probably even outside of all of that, and all of these religions have been an attempt to take over and co-opt that and to control everyone, just like, they're selling the New Age psychedelic religion again. And back, in Roman times, they were selling the Dionysian mysteries in the Bacchanalian festivals where everybody was drunk and high and under the influence of drugs, and then that caused a collapse then too. Now let's think of this for a second, right? If we think of the tree of life, the tree of knowledge, there's the cherubim, the swirling swords, and warning about drugs and the apple from the tree and all of this. Doesn't that mean just play along here that this all happened once before, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
In other words, it's us do you I think let us do the thinking for you because we've got better brains.
right. Well, see, I put 3 ounces of I well, and you're in Ireland right now. I put 3 ounces of Irish butter in my coffee every morning, so I get all those nice fats to help my brain think. Excuse me while I take another chug here. So, let's get into the Rockefeller Committee.
Well, as I say, I did find that they've extensively funded LSD research in the UK, basically Rockefeller. They were also involved with funding at the Maudsley Hospital, which I mentioned before, which is where they were preparing to receive hundreds of thousands of servicemen with post-traumatic stress, and they were, that's I think when they first started using that as a tool before the drugs came in, you know,
Well,
the shock.
sure, and we're about we're just a couple of questions from going into the Tavistock Institute. And the Tavistock Institute, they were set up originally to study the effects of what was it, shell shock on the soldiers in World War I, so that they could turn them around and get them back out into the trenches to die as quickly as possible.
I think they quickly became aware that it had a lot more uses than actually just sending it back, didn't they? Too, they realized that it puts you in a suggestible state, basically.
Sure, but you know, I think the idea, and the idea though is also eugenics. You know, I think you know, putting boys with guns in ditches that their wives made in the factories at home and force them to kill each other is a pretty major system of eugenics. And you know, just getting rid of the mass eaters. Meanwhile, it's the elites who, you know, consume so much resource. I mean, look at the Queen, for instance. I mean, you know, she's got this huge palace. She has to have tens of thousands of people to take care of her. I mean, she probably can't even wipe her own butt. You know, I mean, this is how out of touch with reality and being able to sustain herself this person is. So, I mean, how is somebody like this not the largest detriment to the environment herself while she's trying to blame everybody else out there? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, the royal family, you know, in England, they're sort of loved, and you know, in the papers, the propaganda sort of makes out that it's a valid news item, you know, what they're up to and so on. But the whole thing is again, it's another psyop, you know, royalty, and don't upset the status quo, and it's the distraction, the entertainment value. But of course, they were basically Nazis. They were
Well,
literally.
and we don't want to, you know, the whole history with the Nazis is interesting too, and there is a whole lot of new information coming out with that. The movie The Greatest Story Never Sold. There was Mike Smith's videos, such as Buchenwald, a dumb portrayal of evil. But what you had going on was the Jewish Bolsheviks in Russia between Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin had murdered almost 150 million people. And to cover all of that up, they've kept the focus on the Nazis for the last, you know, 60 some years since, you know, since the 1940s. And so, you know, there's been all of this rampant anti-Germanicism going on through society. And meanwhile, the Zionists down in Palestine are still massacring people. And, you know, but all of this, I think, is a trick, you know, because nobody wants to be racist. And if you know, and they have gotten away with throwing out this you know, anti-Germanic hatred for decades. And meanwhile, you know, there is more and more evidence coming to light to show that it's possible that Hitler may have tried to stop the massacre committed by the Bolshevik Jews on the Russians. So, you know, there's a whole other history beginning to come to light. And of course, the winners write history, and they don't want people to talk about it. And if you talk about any of this, you're, you know, immediately labeled an anti-Semite, when a Semite, when you look it up in the dictionary, is an Arab. And who is killing the Palestinians? Is it us? Hello? You know, so I mean, you know, all of these contradictions and logic and all this. But going back to the Queen and the royal family, let's get into the opium wars.
Oh, well, I mean, I have come across it in my research, just that the colonialism and the East India Tea Company and so on. But I didn't, it's not an area I really looked at, because as I say, I was just trying to follow my own path. But in respect of what you've just said, when I looked at Lady Moran's husband, Lord Moran, he was very much involved in the propaganda to get the boys out to the front. He also went to attend Rudolf Hess. He accompanied him to Nuremberg along with Ewan Cameron and William Sargent and Lord Moran, again, because it was from my background, I came across that. And they locked Rudolf Hess and threw away the key. They wouldn't even let him speak to anybody. And he said he was being hypnotized, he's being mesmerized, that they were giving him drugs. And of course, these, you know, Ewan Cameron was later proven to have done
absolutely
that type of work.
Now, I think the most important thing to realize with the Opium Wars is that, you know, just like the UK did to China and everywhere else, they, you know, the royal family dumped their drug smuggling wares to make them rich. You know, those, I mean, if you probably went back to, you know, China and asked people back then, they would have probably thought that, you know, yeah, you know, we were having a good time and all of this stuff. But if we can take the British Opium Wars forward and switch out opium with psychedelics, I think we see the exact same agenda going on here. And there was, I did come across a reference a couple years ago that Thomas Henry Huxley, who is of course Darwin's bulldog and the eugenicist and grandfather to both, you know, Aldous and Julian, it appears that he may have been one of the key guys behind the Opium Wars, ironically. So, you know, we even have a multi-generational step here to look at the Huxley family and their involvement in these types of operations. So I don't think there is a whole lot of difference, you know, just the drugs themselves, and obviously, you know, it's a different thing. And still today, they're promoting opium and heroin. And in the last few years here in Southern California, heroin, which was almost, you didn't even hear of it hardly 10 years ago, is back in a big way these days. So they are again promoting the heroin. In fact, ever since they got the Taliban out of Afghanistan, they've really been pushing the heroin and, you know, the opiates hard. So anyway, do you have any comment on that?
I just find it tragic. So, you know, to the way it ruins people's lives. And the same with crack cocaine. Apparently, it's very cheap to buy that now as well. And people, it just getting messed up and go completely under for the rest of their lives. That's it, ruined.
You know, and in the 1920s, I forget when they took it off the market, maybe in the 1950s, but here in the United States, you used to be able to just walk into a pharmacy and buy cocaine off the shelf. And it was in Coca-Cola, et cetera. But
yeah, but I mean, the crack cocaine. And
well,
so
well
on.
You know, what? Well, see, that's just it is, you know, these were purified, cheap, easily accessible forms. And to go into a pharmacy back then and buy cocaine off the shelf, and women used to use it in their makeup and stuff, but even that was cheaper than the cheap crack cocaine on the streets today. And we can see the damage that the crack causes and smoking and all this stuff. You know, I think the goal was to get the pure, clean stuff out of the market and, you know, get everything onto the black market, you know, again, like with the Opium Wars, got to have that black market, right? So let's get into this Dr. John Coleman, who is Tavistock Committee of 300. What can you tell us about him?
I don't know anything much about him. He was an ex-MI6 agent, I think. He's so he maintains. I've just seen his lecture, read some of his book. But he's an academic, and he does document a great deal of information about the Tavistock. The fact that it's documented is why really I mention him, because it's the best way is to stick to stuff that's documented. So he's written that book and he's researched it at the British Museum. Now, I've heard rumours that he himself is part of a damage limitation exercise where they just give out, you know, they throw someone to the wolves as a scapegoat and give out a certain amount of information, whether that's the case or not.
Yeah, we see a lot of scapegoating in MKUltra. You know, they're always scapegoating. They always try to send someone with part of the operation off to take all of the blame. In the United States, when MKUltra was first blown up in the press, John D. Marks, who's the author of The Search for the Manchurian Candidate, he's actually the director for the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. And It was him who came, him along with Gordon Wasson and Albert Hoffman and Sidney Cohen, et cetera, who came up with the big scam about James Moore being the CIA agent mole on Wasson's trip to Oaxaca, Mexico, when he supposedly discovered magic mushrooms. But we now know, you know, now we have the MKUltra Subproject 58 documents that show Wasson requesting quote-unquote personnel for the trip. So the whole group, you know, and Wasson's wife was a doctor, so they had a medical professional. James Moore was a scientist later on. You know, they also took Albert Hoffman down there. They would take Richard Evan Schultes down there. But each person, you know, Richard Allen, but each person had a specific job. Like Allen was the photographer, et cetera. So you can see that these were coordinated groups that they put together to do this research. Now, let's switch for a second and go into the World Health Organization, National Institutes of Mental Health. What can you tell us about these establishments?
Right. Well, because I was researching William Gray Walter, you know, because of his links with Lady Moran, I noticed that there was a WHO sponsored conference called the Psychobiological Life of the Child in 1953, but it was attended by the usual suspects, really: Margaret Mead, Frank Fremont Smith, as well as William Gray Walter, also Piaget, who's a French psychiatrist, Bowlby, who's a Tavistock psychiatrist. And then I came to realize that the WHO and also the National Institution for Mental Health were all really, psychiatry in itself, again, also pretty much a psyop. It's MK Ultra stuff. Psychiatry as a whole, I think. Not in the field on the one-to-one level. If you went to a psychiatrist, you might very well meet a very nice one who's tried to help
you. Sure, well, and even then, though, they're using all of this NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, and, you know, subtle hypnosis techniques and things on you, and asking you questions to really pull out a logical conclusion from you, rather than, let's say, if you were to teach the patient critical thinking and how to avoid logical fallacies, then they would have something that they could take with them to use for the rest of their lives. So then when they got into trouble, they wouldn't need to go back to the therapist. But the therapist is really to lead the person, you know, asking these questions. You know, if the person gives a vague answer, well, you know, what do you mean by this? What do you mean by that? You know, and, you know, so, you know, what does this vague statement that you said mean? What are you avoiding here? Instead of teaching the person how to spot their own logical fallacies in their minds and then get themselves out of these loops. So a lot, not all of it, but a lot of psychotherapy seems to be centered around taking advantage of people who don't know logic and critical thinking and then using that on them so that you can make the profit, but don't tell them that you're just basically, in many respects, using critical thinking. Now, I can't make a, you know, blanket statement there. I should put a caveat there, and I have had some doctors reach out to me that you know, from my show, who've provided information things. So they're not all the same, but there are many. So let's talk about compromises and how they get doctors caught up in the system. You want to go into that?
Well, I spent a lot of time thinking about this issue, the good people in the bad organizations. How the heck did they get there? You know, how does this happen? And I just came to realize that it's probably really tiny little compromises that are made.
Like step by step or?
At every level, but then they build up into a big effect because obviously these people, okay, they want to do well in their careers, and so they're trying to please, but they're not stupid and they're not evil. You know, a lot of them are actually very good people, and they think they're doing great stuff.
Why don't you give us an example of one of the techniques they might use, or you know, several to get somebody caught up in their stuff?
Well, I think because the health services are so hierarchical, and because people are trained to unquestioningly obey the authority of the person above them. I think that's how it happens. They don't question, and psychopaths tend to rise in these organizations too, and they're extremely good at manipulation. Blackmail in intelligence services obviously is widely used, you know, but I don't think it's always even that extreme. I think a lot of times it's more subtle. It's a kind of career thing. It's like, I want to do well in my career, so I'm going to go along with what my boss says.
Right.
Simple as that, really.
Just following orders.
Yeah.
What can you say about, well, actually, we covered the Tavistock Institute already with Coleman, et cetera. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add regarding Tavistock and their intentions?
Well, I sort of came to think that probably the type of experimentation I was involved with was something to do with a Tavistock agenda, to perpetuate the breakdown of social strengths on a kind of Frankfurt School basis, where you're promoting homosexuality, promoting free love, promoting aggressive feminism. And looking back at what possibly it could have been, I was moved back up to the north of England at the age of 12 with a head full of ideas about, I mean, I was only 12, but about women's lib and free love. And that's what I went back with, and that's what I was behaving once I got back there to my school. But in Rochdale, up in the north, people are quite resistant to new ideas and trendy things. So I think they were actually getting some kids down there in the south and then sending them out back, because other children, other twins in my class and in my school were sent home at the age of 12 too, and they'd come from the north of England. In fact, the family next door of the house we moved into came from 4 miles away from than we came from. You know, it was that. I haven't got any evidence, but that's my kind of feeling. It was something to do with this kind of Tavistock agenda and promoting it.
And the Beatles also came out of the Tavistock Institute, et cetera, and they were heavily involved with Tim Leary and I think Michael Hollingshead was also involved there with the Beatles. And then they were also involved with Marshall McLuhan, et cetera. Now, you mentioned twins, so you're obviously a twin. And you were involved, you believe, in twin experiments. What can you tell us about that? But first off, before you answer that, tell us the difference between you and your sister.
Okay, well, my sister was very conventional in that she married at the age of 18, had one partner and lived in one house for until just recently. She just moved now for the first time. Whereas I just kept, well,
yeah, you had the average hippie lifestyle. Is that what you're trying to not say in so many words?
Say that. But I also ran away from home at the age of 6 and at the age of 9. And I was reading before I went to school. I was very sort of, we were hothoused by my mother I seriously ran away from home at the age of 6 to make my home elsewhere. I really wanted to do that. I was brought back by the police, but I had to get away because I felt like I was being, it was detrimental to me to be.
Now, what was going on there that, you know, if you look at things in context of MKUltra and seeing it in this new light, that their goal was the counterculture, was to break the family unit, was to break us as people, and you see your sister have the stable life and yours not so much, and then you consider these twin studies that you're talking about, doesn't that seem like what they were studying, how they could break people? You know, one person goes up and has a stable, solid family life, you know, that backbone there, and then the other one doesn't. Doesn't that seem like what they would have been studying?
Yes, it does. And I really want to kind of try and find some. I did find the bases in Bath were Admiralty, and I did find a reference to the Admiralty funding child behavioural studies, but I've not been able to get that document back up again, unfortunately, because I thought, oh, you know, maybe this was it. Maybe this was what they were doing. But definitely, you see, because they can, they've got both twins have the same environment. So whatever they do to one, they know that is what's caused, probably caused the results because they've got the two there. One is a control, haven't they? So goodness knows what they were doing.
So you probably weren't the one that was the control, I'm guessing. Is that correct?
I was actually, as I say, sexually abused. My sisters weren't, so.
Very interesting. All right. So what else can you tell us about the twin experiments themselves? Do you have more data on them?
I don't much know. There was a guy based in Bath in Somerset who's famous for twin experiments called Cyril Burt, and he was a eugenicist, but he was discredited later on. Apparently, he falsified some of his results, but he was the major name in England associated with twin research. But he was, as I say, he was based in Bath, which is a bit of a coincidence. I don't know whether he was involved or
And you
not.
were in Bath as well, correct? At the base. Okay. So you interviewed your parents to figure out what was going on. What happened with that?
Well, a few shocking things. My mum said her mum always maintained that my mum was a twin. And I said, "Well, where's the other twin?" She says, "Oh, my mum, no, she's just saying that." But that. My mum's circumstances are very congruent with being a twin because she only weighed 3 pounds, but she was fully formed and survived at home. Whereas if she'd been premature and only weighed 3 pounds, she wouldn't have been developed properly and would have died. So I said, "Well, where's the twin?" She said, "Well, my mum said that they took it away. It was crying in the cotton room, and then they took it away." She says, "Oh, well, that won't be true." I'm like, "What? Probably is true. I think it is true." So that was a bit of a shock. And then my mum and dad said about, well, my mum said about Lady Moran, that was important. And her mum. Oh, yeah. And of course, there was another child taken away in the family. My mum's cousin was taken away. Well, his mother was taken away and then down south to be educated away from the family. And then her son ended up as this sort of mega guy involved in helping Thatcher to reorganize the government. He was worked in the Pentagon. He worked in Whitehall. This chap, who's my mum's cousin, that we've never even heard of, and but his mum was taken away from the family to be educated away from the family. So there's another thing I found out. It's lots of things like this that have made me come to these conclusions,
How did your parents act when you wanted to interview them?
Oh, they were fine. The first thing when I first brought the subject up, I said, I think maybe something like mind control happened to our family. And they said, "Oh, well, yeah, it might have done." What? And then my mum followed me into the other room and said, "Be careful who you're talking to. We don't want you disappearing." And then I'm like, "Oh my goodness, I think I'm onto something here." But I think they don't really know. But I think my mum's got a suspicion. Well, both of them, that something might have happened. But
And
the doctor.
you recorded them on camera?
I have the recording on camera.
All right. So really, we'll have to we're gonna fly through the last questions because you have to go quickly here. So did you have anything to add about Lady Moran, who she was?
Well, she was a scientist who worked at Porton Down in the chemical warfare department under Sir Joseph Barcroft, who was the head of that department. So that was another shock. My mum just mentions a random name. That took me right into MKUltra research.
And she was of blood, right? Lady
Well,
Moran, obviously, right?
it was her husband who was the lord, in the chap who was Churchill's doctor, who was from Ulster, actually plantation Irish, I think, sent over from England to, infiltrate the Irish, basically.
And what about let's just kind of go through these really quickly. So Lord Moran's student was William Sargent.
Again, William Sargent.
Right, and William Sargent authored Battle for the Mind, and William Sargent ran many of the UK's MKUltra and related studies there. Is that correct?
Yeah, he had a sleep room, which was the same, almost identical to what Ewan Cameron had, where patients were kept asleep. There was a whole basement patients kept asleep for over a month in some cases, given large amounts of LSD and electric shock treatment way above the normal amount in order to reprogram them. But these patients were only there for trivial, really, relatively trivial conditions. It's dreadful, really. Like postnatal depression again.
All right, and who was Joseph Barcroft?
Well, he was Lady Moran's tutor, and I found out that he was also the head of the Port and Down warfare department, chemical warfare department. And so I was looking at people around him, and he was also William Grey Walter's tutor, who comes up at the Macy Conference. And he also was associated with Julian Huxley, Barcroft, or I think he authored a paper with Huxley. I found two connections between Barcroft and Huxley for about 20 years apart. So they seem to be maintaining contact. So I haven't really got that far, but stuff is coming up, and you get these names keep coming up, and the associations, they're quite tight, really. So I think, the more you can put out, it just helps with the researchers anyway.
And who is William Grey Walter?
He was the cybernetician who attended the Macy conferences and was very pioneering in the recording of brain waves. He also apparently determined the flicker rate of a television, which would produce the most hypnotic effects. Quite eclectic, but number of areas that he was involved with. He was at the first leucotomy, the first, he did psychosurgery himself, but he was also a cybernetician, actually building little robots that would respond in a Pavlovian way to stimulus.
What is synthetic hypnosis, since you just talked about TV and hypnosis? And that was my next question, was television as well. So cover both of those.
Right, well, it's where you use lights and mechanical, basic strobe lights to get people to go into a trance.
And
And
what
he's
most
measuring the brain waves at the same time to see, make sure that they were with, that they were going into trances.
Well, and what most people don't realize is when you're in that state where time goes by really quickly, that is actually hypnosis. So, all right. So, and then going back to William Sargent, isn't he the one that was first pioneered lobotomies in the UK? Or what's his story with lobotomy?
He is as well. He wanted to perform a lobotomy, but the Greater London Council wouldn't let him. They refused permission, so he persuaded his colleague Ross Ashby to have carry it out to, I think, Barnwood Hospital, where they operated on five patients, and one had just come into hospital 5 days previously because he had neurosis due to shell shock. And 5 days later, they were giving him a lobotomy, one of the first patients to have a lobotomy. And Sargent was also present at the first electric shock treatments as well in the UK.
Interesting. And I've covered a lot on electroshock with Dr. Colin Ross on my show here. And so what is the psychobiological development of children, and how does all of this play in?
Well, as I say, you have the usual suspects attending those conferences, Margaret Mead, Frank Ferment-Smith, and a range of Tavistock psychiatrists, Bowlby.
Your typical group of psychopaths that parade around as doctors trying to kill off everyone and mind control them.
And now they're at child conferences. And then after that, child guidance clinics were opened throughout the UK as a result of those lectures. And therefore, they were up to something in terms of children and manipulation of children, that's for sure.
All right, and do
You
you
can get
know?
the You can get the whole transcript of that conference online. It's in one of those American library set things that save documents and print them online. I can't remember what it's called now, but it is available.
If you remember it, send it to me, and I'll include it in the show notes for people.
Yeah.
And who were some of the other UK researchers that were at the MACI conferences? Do you know?
They were, as you said, the ones you've mentioned, Mead and Bateson, but the also William Gray Walter and Ross Ashby mainly were the main ones they were the ones that I've come across. There were no others that really stood out. But as I say, I've been doing all this from my own perspective, and that's given me the drive, to really look into this stuff. So I know it's a bit kind of skewed because it's not a proper academic study. It just goes into the areas that might give me a clue about what happened to me. That's what I've done. So
Right. All right. What is the ratio, or what was the ratio group?
the ratio group, yeah, they're really interesting. It was an exclusive association, a group of cyberneticians and scientists who formed to talk about cybernetics in the UK. And one of the people who attended, well, there's several from Bletchley Park who were involved in the intelligence services as well as these cyberneticians. Alan Turing, for example, and other Bletchley Park people, and they invited the cyberneticians from the USA to come and talk there. So in a way, it was a way where they could all get together. And when you look at the people attending that, you think that, well, they must have been involved in the MK, or the where cybernetics and MK Ultra come together, really. So where your psychiatry is becoming mechanical and how it can be implemented, they would be able to talk off the record at these meetings. And I think studying that particular group would be useful, for this MK Ultra research. Yeah.
And then there's, we've got Dr. Andrea Puhrich, who is involved in a lot of the MKUltra research, and he's all over the place. He also promoted Uri Geller and Arrigo, et cetera. And we also know that he worked with a guy, what was it, John Fuller, wrote the book The Day of St. Anthony's Fire, which was basically the first book on MKUltra research activities. And Fuller has never been exposed yet regarding his activities in MKUltra. I've actually written a long article that's going to expose all of his involvement as well, and I've researched out all of that. Do you have anything to add regarding Puhrich?
Well, excuse me. The Ratio Club was inspired by McCulloch, Warren McCulloch, and he came to the meetings. He also went to the Birmingham LSD unit and gave a talk there about cybernetics and psychiatry. But McCulloch himself was associated with
Andrea Puric. Yeah, it's one of those crazy Yugoslavian names, Serbian type names.
Apparently, they founded a round table foundation of electrobiology together in the 1940s. Poharich
All right, who was Joel Elkes?
Joel Elkes was a doctor. He worked for Porton Down. He was the guy that actually ran and founded the Department of Experimental Psychiatry at Birmingham University Hospital, which was the LSD experimentation unit. However, according to Albury, he was also working at, well, he was working at Queen Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington under MK Ultra. According to Al Borelli, he was associated with Dr. Isbell. He also worked for Johns Hopkins University for MK Ultra as well. So the implication being that this Birmingham University Hospital was probably also part of the MK Ultra activities because he opened it, and he did a lot of work on he kind of pioneered several of the psychiatric medicines, but he was working on chemical warfare too, studying chemical warfare at Portendown himself too.
All right, we have just a few more questions here. Do you still have time to just finish up a few more?
Yeah, I should be all right for another 5 or 10.
All right, yeah, that's about what it's going to be, is about 10 total. All right, so let's get to the NCDS and the child development surveys. What can you tell us about that?
Right. Well, that was the survey that I was part of because the year of my the week I was born in was the week that they said, right, every child in that survey, in that born in that week, is going to be part of this survey that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
Now, that survey, along with quite a lot of other surveys, was administered from the London School of Economics, and I found out that where William Gray Walter worked himself was called the Burden Neurological Institute, and the people, the Burdens, who funded that institute, were themselves interested in doing national surveys, but they wanted to put everyone who didn't pass at the age of 11, pass this sort of test, into a big mental colony. That was their idea in the
Right.
1920s,
Well,
into a big mental colony to work for free. And that again was administered from the London School of Economics. When they actually did a huge survey on Scottish mental surveys on people, and they were actually thinking of doing something along those lines, but obviously they decided to do a more clandestine version in the end, which is what we have now.
I have some interesting ties for you here, because Gordon Wass and the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms, he went to the London School of Economics, and the Tavistock Institute was created out of the London School of Economics, and also Arnold J. Toynbee was London School of Economics, as was David Rockefeller, George Soros, etc. But we also have another interesting connection here, because Bronislaw Malinowski, who is Margaret Mead's professor, was at London School of Economics. All right, so Alexander Carr Saunders was a director, I believe, of the London School of Economics, and then his son, who I'm just about to ask you here, Nick Saunders, founded, I believe, Freestonia and the whole free love, free sex, so-called liberation movement by destroying any sort of organization or anything around. So why don't you cover Nick Saunders in that for a moment?
That's right, Nick Saunders dad. That's what I was just going to say. Again, the director of London School of Economics, and where he himself was an arch
Quote
hippie.
unquote. Well, they don't actually believe it, they sell it, you know.
Also, a psychonaut, if you like. He was very involved in consciousness. Raise in himself, experimenting with his consciousness, but and he was even a member of the Santa Dame, if that's how you pronounce
Santo
it.
Daime, yeah. That's Santo Daime and the UDV, or Uno de Vegetal, are both ayahuasca churches.
Yeah, very much a conscious experimentation, but the other fact that I found out was he was a member of the Process Church too.
And of course, the Process Church ties directly to Charles Manson and the whole Laurel Canyon scene that I've exposed so much with Dave McGowan on my show. So Nick Saunders, Process Church, he was, and then that goes right into Charles Manson, Robert Moore, the Cotton Club murders, John Phillips, Son of Sam, that whole thing, Cass Elliot, that whole thing can go blow, it can all be blown out from there. And then Nick Saunders also knew Terrence McKenna, Robert Anton Wilson. So apparently, Saunders, with his father at London School of Economics and with all of these key figures surrounding London School of Economics, was apparently selling the same agenda. Whether he made it look spiritual and all of this stuff is probably irrelevant to the underlying agenda that they were really using there. And, you know, I'm always afraid, you know, it's like when they sell spirituality and mysticism on top, it's usually, you know, going back to what I said earlier, mysticism is the tool of tyrants. That's usually how, you know, one of the key ways that you can spot these guys, because in logic, there's something called the onus of proof. And always the mystical claims always 100% of the time fail the onus of proof. And this is how we know somebody's trying to fool us, because, you know, the essentially what they are then doing is they're arguing the arbitrary. That's an argument without evidence, and which is automatically thrown out, right? Just by default, because it's not on you to support their claim. It's on them to supply the evidence always. Anytime anyone makes a claim, it's on them to support their own argument.
Right. Yeah, well, that is so interesting. Yeah, this is an area I really want.
This is an area what? Yeah, don't click the mute button.
I really would like to continue to look into this firm link between Saunders and the hippie movement in the UK and the MK Ultra shower. And I'm finding other links. For example, there were two Nicks that worked closely together. They were best friends. There was Nick Albury and Nick Saunders. And Albury actually authored books with R.D. Lang, and he was another person that really promoted the arcade.
R.D. Lang was next on the list, and it's wild how people promote him and Tavistock. And of course, R.D. Lang was also at the Millbrook Mansion with Timothy Leary and the others. You know, just like the Esalen Institute, the Millbrook Mansion seems to have been a key center that future agents came out of or went to help them.
Well, yeah, that's interesting, because I noticed an MI6 agent long involved in the intelligence services called Robert Moss was also a speechwriter for Mrs. Thatcher, and he was recently teaching at the Esalen. He was teaching dream research, dream workshops where people could enter each other's dreams.
Yeah. So what you do is you use hypersuggestibility to make them think that they're entering each other's dreams, and then you collect money on it. So, did you dare to cover Elms and any of the relation to the pedophile DJ Jimmy Savile? I know a lot of people want to stay away from that one.
Let's see. Jimmy Savile. Yeah. Not so much. I mean, I'm from Rochdale, and there's another MP, a mate of Jimmy Savile's, who's been found to have been a paedophile now, Cyril Smith, who was called Rochdale. So there's a kind of connection with my hometown and Jimmy Savile, of course. But no, I haven't looked into the Elms and all that business.
Well, we didn't cover, I don't know if we have enough time, but we didn't cover Nick Albury and what is Bit or the Bitman magazine or the connections between Bath, Somerset, the Masons, and Cecil Rhodes. Do you have time to cover those before we wrap it up?
Well, maybe basically, Albury, as I said, he was a close friend of Nick Saunders and was involved in the beginnings of the Free Festival movement. So this is where the Free Festival movement was, where all these like people in these really far out clothes, you know, like fringe jackets and staying in teepees around campfires. It's wonderful, but they were actually associated with the CIA, and they were actually all the aristocracy kids that were starting it off. Like,
well, and that's the idea, is the upper class kids do it. But what you saw there was actually Gregory Bateson's native revivalism. This is exactly how they implement this against their target group. So they just flipped it backwards. And Gregory Bateson, even in his OSS letter, warns about how it could be used against the rest of society. So, well, what is the single most important concept that you would like people to remember from our interview today?
Concept. That's a hard question. Well, first of all, I think, part of my research is like kind of saying, look, I think everyone can look at the backgrounds and come a couple of steps in either direction. They'll find MKUltra themselves, because so many people say, "Well, what can I do?" If you're interested and you research your own background, maybe we can put a pitch together with lots and lots of people doing this. Really, I'm not an academic, and I'm not doing a Sarah job. I'm plowing my own furrow for my own life, you know. And I'd say it's well worth doing if you've got the time to put into that. But the internet isn't what it used to be. The documents aren't there anymore. You know, they're not free, and they're certainly not free anymore. The journals and the academic papers and the scientific articles, but just basically this, you know, turn off your telly and start digging. That's what I think. But in terms of the, I perhaps would also like to repeat what I said in my lecture about in terms of the archaic revival. I know we touched on it, but a lot of power lies in our hands, because if we do take on board those skills of survivalist skills, they're very powerful and very dangerous.
Well, the issue is the archaic revival that they were selling, that McKenna was selling, which was just a readaptation of Gregory Bateson's native revivalism. That was actually a new dark age that they were selling, not just, you know, survival skills and you know, being able to take care of yourself, you know, raising some animals on your own ranch or farm or, you know, cabin out in the country. The goal with that was to return us as serfs and as the most suppressed class of people. So we have to be careful in, you know, their promotion of those ideas.
No, it's weird, isn't it? Because don't they really want to get us all into these mega super cities now?
Well, but, you know, the issue is, you know, and there's a famous quote that I often read from Louis Jolyon West, and he talks about how getting the kids into the communes, and I'll read this real quick and then you can go, but how that was one of the most effective ways of dealing with it. You know, we can't just look at the surface on how they want to control things, because if they're selling, you know, anti-technology, anti-family, anti-farm structure, selling the vegetarian diet, which is very ruinous to the health. I was a vegetarian for many years. It almost killed me. But when we look at all of these things combined, we can see the agenda here. So this is what Dr. Louis Jolyon West, who is one of the CIA's MKUltra doctors, and he's been exposed many times by many others, he says, "The role of drugs in the exercise of political control is also coming under increasing discussion. Control can be through the prohibition or supply. The total or even partial prohibition of drugs gives the government considerable leverage for other types of control. An example would be the selective application of drug laws permitting immediate search or no-knock entry against selected components of the population, such as members of certain minority groups or political organizations. But a government could also supply drugs to help control a population. This method, foreseen by Aldous Huxley in Brave New World, 1932, has the governing element employing drugs selectively to manipulate the governed in various ways. To a large extent, the numerous rural and urban communes, which provide a great freedom for private drug use and where hallucinogens are widely used today, are actually subsidized by our society. Their perpetuation is aided by parental or other family remittances, welfare and unemployment payments, and benign neglect by the police. In fact, it may be far more convenient and perhaps even far more even more economical to keep the growing numbers of chronic drug users, especially of hallucinogens, fairly isolated and out of the labor market with its millions of unemployed. To society, the communards with their hallucinogenic drugs are probably less bothersome and less expensive if they are living apart than if they are engaging in alternative modes of expressing their alienation, such as active, organized, vigorous political protest and dissent. The hallucinogens presently compromise a moderate but significant portion of the total drug problem in Western society. The foregoing may provide a certain frame of reference against which not only the social but also the clinical problems created by these drugs can be considered." So again, we see that that is absolutely the agenda, and that's why they're promoting this native revivalist, archaic revival thing. Gregory Bateson, as you full well know, was OSS. This was not an agenda just to get people to live off in the country somewhere. All of
associating that right. with drugs, aren't they?
It's a multi-pronged attack to break the whole of society. And when we get that, you know, they want us to live in teepees and in communes rather than building families and lives and a strong, you know, familial backbone structure, then we get the plan, we get the, you know, how Agenda 21 is implemented on the public.
That's brilliant. That's a great quote. Wow. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, do you have any websites? Are you planning on writing a book? Where can people see your videos, etc.? And we'll try to link anything you give us here.
Yeah, I have a website. It's not been updated recently, but there's quite a lot on it. It's and my interviews are all there too. It's mk.gowebs.co.uk.
All right. And do you have anything else to add before we wrap it up?
Just great to talk to you, Jan. I've learned loads as well. And thanks, everyone who helped with the computer. I'm going to be carrying on doing some more research, a lot more research.
So, and I got to say, it's amazing how much better you look. You know, last time our connection dropped constantly. And your picture is very clear and very sharp, and I'm very happy that you got that taken care of, and I'm sure the audience who contributed would be happy as well. So thanks for coming on, and thanks to the audience for helping you out.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.